Welcome to the Dublin Festival of History podcast, brought to you by Dublin City Council. In this episode from the Dublin Festival of History 2023, Enda Finnan examines the Navan Road parish area and the transformation of the rural community and landscapes of the townlands of Greater Cabra, Ashtown and Pelletstown from the 1920s to the 1960s. He connects the dots between migration and change of land ownership and development. Enda Finnan is a local resident and historian. This episode was recorded at Cabra Library on the 12th of October 2023.
My name is Enda Finnan, and talking tonight to how this area around here, the Navan Road, changed in the mid-century from being a fairly rural area towards being the suburb that we know today, and what was there before, and how it changed. And I'm going to leave this just to read here. This is by Frank Flanagan, who's down in the corner, fantastic sketch of life in the area in the 40s. I'll give you a second to read it. So a thoroughly rural scene. There's hay carts, people discussing crops, a slow pace of life, cycling home together. Yet within, this was soon after the war, yet within 20 years, the area was soon on the way to be transformed, totally unrecognisable. So this didn't happen by itself. It wasn't just here it happened. There was broader trends. You could bring it back to the start of the 20th century when Dublin City Council decided, or Dublin Corporation decided to move out. But even really, you have to bring it back further, another 100 years, to the Act of Union. In the 18th century, Dublin was a very wealthy city. Georgian City was built then. We had Grattan's Parliament, the Irish Parliament in College Green. So you had a lot of wealth from the country. The gentry had houses in the city, the great Georgian houses. There's many are still there. And around the Parliament, what you had was all the people that feed off of Parliament, lobbyists, lawyers, accountants, and that whole coterie of people lived in those houses, were part of the social scene, the economic scene. But then what happened to them after the Act of Union, which came in after the 1798 rebellion, the British decided to unify the two parliaments because there was too much trouble coming out of the Irish Parliament. So they moved the power centre of Ireland back to London. And what happened was that these people moved back with them that were living in these grand houses. And they'd come back occasionally for the winter season, the big social season where people come in from the country and back from London. But that faded over time after 1801. And these turned into tenements. So they let them out to house agents that had to return a certain amount of money to the owners. And the owners didn't care. Because they'd stopped coming back. They didn't care what was done to them. And so these house jobbers, they put in the maximum people, the minimum investment, and that's how they made their money and returned some to London. So what also happened, like, these were horrendous conditions to live in. TB was through the roof. Like, before the famine, there was 353 tenements in Dublin. After the famine, at the end of the famine, there was 6,000 tenements, and there was up to 100,000 people living in them. So they were awful conditions, but the thing is, you have to remember the city as it was just inside the canals. That was what Dublin City, that's where all the work was. So that's where people needed to live in order to turn a pound. The other thing was, Dublin wasn't an industrial city like Belfast and Manchester, Birmingham. It was a commercial city. It lived off the port and the agriculture going through the port. So there was very little skilled labour. It was all unskilled labour, so men were dockers and carters and labourers. Women, if they were in paid employment, were generally in domestic service. So lots of unskilled work. They couldn't afford it and better, and all the work was in the middle of town. That's where the tenements were, so that's where they had to live. There was also, if you think after the famine, the rural poverty of people known that relying on the land could go horribly wrong. Not just in Ireland, but all over the Western world, people left the farms and headed for the cities. Again, it was easier to get around with trains. There was more mechanisation on farms, so people, there wasn't a need for people, and there was more rural poverty. They'd take their chances in the city. So this would all kept replenishing the tenements, and Dublin got into a worse state inside the canals. And worse again, the professional classes all moved out in the second half of the 20th century to places like Rat Mines, Ratgar, Donegal, essentially Dublin 4 and 6, as we call it today. So that meant there was a loss of income to the corporation. They couldn't afford to keep the place in health and safety wise, and things were spiralling downwards. So the reason for the, I'll only show you one graph, but this one, this is the population of 26 counties since 1821, the blue line. And you see a peak just before the famine at 6.5 million and then plummeted to 1961 to less than 3 million. But the orange line is the population of Dublin. And it kept climbing from 300,000 to 700,000. But that's where everybody was headed. So something had to give. It was a disaster waiting to happen. The disaster happened in on the 2nd of September 1913 when two tenement buildings collapsed in Church Street, killing 7 people, including 2 children. And now, they weren't the first tenement collapses, but the city was in ferment at the time because the lockout was ongoing. This was just 2 days after Bloody Sunday, the lockout Bloody Sunday, when the police baton charged the lockout workers in O'Connell Street when Larkin appeared at the hotel. So the city was in ferment. The authorities were worried, so something had to be done. So they instituted an inquiry at the end of 1913. Right. Now, if you're ever feeling too good about the world, you should open this, download this, because it's grim beyond belief in what it tells. And the pictures are grim. This is all, the one over there on the far side, that's off North King Street. This, the one in the middle here, down Beresford Street. As you see, the buildings, all these are all occupied buildings, and they all look on the state of collapse. And you see the old woman with the water pump. So typically, there's one water pump. There could be up to 100 people living in the house. One water pump, one toilet. And in the report that the investigators say, they can't understand how man or woman could use the toilets that they've seen. And they're in such condition. And on top of that, they commented that that no childhood innocence could survive the tenements. So you can join your own dots of that there was multi-generation, one family in one room. There was people coming in off the streets, the door always open. So their recommendation was, you have to get rid of these tenements. We have to get the population out of the city centre to what they called virgin soil on the city edge. Now, the city edge at that stage was about here. It's not the city we know today. And there was a series of reports said this. So that was 1913, 1914 report. There was a report, a very important man called Patrick Abercrombie, who really laid out the city in the 20th century. He had a report in 1922 that said this should happen. Dublin Council report in 1918, North City Survey in 1918, 1925 Civic Survey, they all came to the conclusion, we need to get out of the city and build on the edge, single family dwellings. And this is another reason why Dublin ended up going low rise, because multi-dwelling units to the people from the city centre were tenements. They said, I'm not going from that into that. And the planners also said, we're not making new tenements on the edge. Give everybody front garden, back garden, as the Civic Survey had a line that they put them in places where the father would have a little garden to cultivate, the mother would have a place to dry her clothes, and the children would have somewhere free of traffic chaos. So that's what was to be done. So if we look back, what was it? You had rashers here again in the tenement. So the idea was to move people out of the centre. So Marino here was the first one in the 1920s. Colester, that was for veterans of the war. Drumcondra, Cabarin, Frumlin were in the 40s. The 50s was Ballyfermot and Finglas. So it was to get people out into single unit housing, was the plan. So the man I mentioned earlier, Patrick Abercrombie, he was was brought back again. So the first plan he had for thinning out the city, he made that in 1914. But it was an entry to a competition. An aristocrat ran to say, what the hell could we do? He won that. So it wasn't official, but he was brought back in the late 1930s to another report to say what we should do with the city. And he said, the centre should be monumental, so it should be for the religious institutions, the religious institutions, political institutions, artistic institutions. The only people need to live in the middle of the city are people who work there, so dockers in particular. He said, okay, they're going to need everybody else. We should move out to the edge. And in particular, he identified Drumcondra, Drumtarf, Cabra, and Crumlin as the locations. They said we needed 19,000 houses. There were 16,000 on the books already about to be built, and they were the areas, you said, that should be targeted. Now, for our own area, if we zoom in on that map to show the sort of influence that his thinking had. So this is Cabra East here, and this is Cabra West. So what this map is coded to show is this sort of brownish colour with the white stripes. That was for local authority housing. And then the brownish colour with the dark stripes, that was for, he said, it should be private housing in that area. So he recommended, this had already been built. Cabra East was built in the late 20s and the 30s. Cabra West was about to be started when he was making his recommendation. And so he recommended that the area we call the Navan Road should be private housing area, as you see around here. I mentioned he was into thinning out the centre. So one of the things he said was that there should be... The hospitals should move out. So have two hospitals on the north side, two on the south side. And the two on the north side were to be the Mater and the Richmond, which used to be off Brunswick Street. And he wanted, as part of the thinning out, that the Brunswick Street Hospital, Richmond Street, the Richmond Hospital, was to be moved out. And it was to be moved here, where we're sitting now. This land around here was grazing land for the cattle market, and the Department of Public Health, as it was, bought it in the 50s, and the idea was to move the Richmond Hospital here. Now, it never happened. Richmond ultimately moved to Beaumont, but that's people of an age with me that can just remember this nothing here except a few sheep until the 1990s. That was the reason the Department of Health owned it and never got around to putting a hospital here. So the area, talk about the Navan Road Parish and Greater Cabra. So Greater Cabra is the townland we're in now. So townlands are a very ancient unit of lands. They go back to Gaelic chieftain times, and they were peculiar in that they're not all the same size, that they were based on, they should have the same value. So if you've good land, the townland was small, bad land, the townland was bigger. So the idea, every townland you could make the same amount of agricultural money from. So the townland here is Greater Cabra, and I have it here in sort of the blue, I know it might be hard to see, the blue dotted, looks like a bird at the top, sort of sticking its head across the canal, and then it comes along the Phoenix Park wall, goes up Ratholt Road, and skips out a little bit of Ashington there. So that's Greater Cabra. Over what we would call Cabra West, that was Little Cabra, or sometimes they were called Much Cabra and Less Cabra. no value judgment there. The green dotted area is the Navan Road Parish, which takes in most of Greater Cabra there, and a little bit of Pellettstown up where the halfway house is and where Plunkett's pitches are. And then Ashtown, the Ashtown townland, most of which was up here where the golf course, Elm Green Golf Course, is now. But a little bit of it up there where Belleville is at the top, just before you get to the Ashtown town gate. That's the parish. So the area I'm looking at here is really the area in yellow, which is a combination of Navan Road Parish and the bits of Greater Cabra that aren't in the Navan Road Parish, which is essentially Cabra Convent, the Bogies, and St. Joseph's across the street. So this is that area as was in the 1911 map. So, and it didn't change a whole lot between 1935. That's why I'm using this map. And there was very little, as you can see, doesn't seem to be a whole lot here, but when you dig a little bit deeper, there is. In terms of up here, this is Cabra Convent. So the Dominicans moved here in 1819. They'd previously been in Clontarf and in what's now Brunswick Street. So they moved here, as I say, 1819, and in 1820 they set up a school for the local poor children. And then in 1846, that's when they started educating deaf girls. They had a connection to France, and they went over and learned how to do that. But initially they came on... When they came, there was 12 acres of land they bought ultimately belonged to a family called the Seagraves, who we'll say a little bit more about. But as you can see, this is where their land developed. They got to 320 acres, by the time they sold it for housing. So it reached all the way from Ratoat Road, all the way up to where the mother and baby home starts, up near Martin Savage Park, was all Dominican land. Down the road from them, across the road from us now, was St. Joseph's Deaf and Dumb Institute, as was called. And this like the Dominicans' land, this was a farm, not as big in extent, but you can see it's fairly big. And they had, since 1857, they were set up. The Christian Brothers ran this. They had boarders from all over Ireland. You see they have a football pitch here beside it. So it was set up by a local priest from the parish of St. Paul's, which is down near the Keys, a Father Yore, who was a big mover and shaker at the time. He's buried in the O'Connell Circle there, which is where the grandees of the day were buried. But there's a couple of interesting things that might be hard to see here, but there's a house here. So this is Ratoat Road. So Cabra Cross here, going up to Ratoat Road. This house here is Cabra House. So that was the seat of the Seagrave family. So they owned huge amounts of land in this area. They were here, they're a Danish family going way back. So they were here and they were on the wrong side of the Battle of Clontarf. And after they were driven out of Dublin after that, and they moved out to Cabra. That's what brought them here. And they still owned well into the 18th century. They still owned swathes of land. But they built this house in 1590 and they lived in it until 1910, or various generations of their family did. There was another house a little bit further on. Today it would be at the corner of Broome Bridge and Fossa Avenue. And that was Cabra Villa. So the Rathbones, who people might know from the name up near Ashtown, that had the factory up there that made candles and polish, they lived there for a time. And in the 19th century, a family called the Keoghs, specifically a man called Christopher Keogh, was resident there. So they were cattle people, so they kept cattle on the land there to bring to the market down the road every Thursday. They also owned a house a little bit across the canal. So if we go to the map here, that's where's Broome Bridge. Broome Bridge is here. So that was Broome Bridge House. They owned that. There was a relative in there. And Villa Park House they owned as well, where Villa Park gets its name from. So that was down near where Neffin Road and Blackhurst Avenue meet. People, again, of my vintage might remember the Plummer family. They lived in Villa Park House. That was a big old farmhouse that they lived in. So up the road, what was St. Vincent de Paul? So again, had land. This is a picture from a little bit later when there's some development, but it had this land behind it here, another working farm. This dated from the 1880s. 1881, this was built as a workhouse. So it was an auxiliary workhouse, an overflow workhouse from the Richmond, the Brunswick Street Richmond workhouse. So in 1888, the Dominicans from down the road took it on. It was for children, orphan children, who were to be trained in agricultural work. Initially, it was senior, I don't know if inmates is the right term, but older people in the institute, in the workhouse, taught the younger people. That didn't work out. They got the Dominicans in, and they only stayed a couple of years. In 1892, the sisters, Daughters of Charity, Vincent de Paul, took it over. So, and if you see this picture, this is from the 1950s in the corner, no distance away, but it's a religious procession through St. Vincent's. It looks like a May Day procession. But at the back are the nuns, and they have this strange big bonnet on their head. They call it cornet. It's a French headdress for nuns. So that's because the order of nuns, the Vincent de Paul, came from France originally. Across the street, there was another. Those same nuns of Vincent de Paul ran the mother and baby home. Now, initially, this was another workhouse built in 1910, and it was for orphan children. And the nuns were brought in by the Dublin Board of Guardians, the County Council, it would be today, to run it. So at the start, it was for orphan children, and like Vincent de Paul, it was to teach people agricultural labour and then find them a place when they were too old for it. But in time, from 1919, it became for mothers and babies, not yet a mother and baby home, but for very sick children, terminally sick children, orphans, children on their way to industrial school as a holding area. But then over time evolved, became the mother and baby home that we've heard about. Now, it too had a working farm. So this picture here, again, I know it's in distance. This is the tin box here. This is the halfway house. And so this was the mother and baby home building itself. And you see a farm, this is a barn here. So the farm that ran down to where Plunkett's pitches are now and Martin Savage Park is now. Another soccer pitch here. So we see with the sporting freely delectation of the area before development was two soccer pitches at either end of the town. So then residential wise, there's not much there, but there is what I've circled here. So you have on Blackhurst Avenue, that's where most of the population was. So you had St. Joseph's Colleges, St. Vincent's Colleges, Elm Grove Colleges, and Bagot Colleges. Now the first three of them were all RDC, County Council, Rural County Council, essentially colleges. So the agricultural labourers are a lot better than the industrial labourers in the 19th century. There's a whole programme of building cottages. You can see like the ones at Roosevelt Colleges, another example, the cottages on the Navan Road, diagonally opposite the Garda station. And you'll see them around, you see some out in Artain. So they were built for rural labourers. So they were better looked at than the industrial workers that I showed you the pictures of earlier. So here we had the population centre was really along Blackhurst Avenue for agricultural workers. So who was here? So this is a map of the area. It's driven up by divided by land boundaries, and just the people who occupied the land in 1930. So the blue bit here, that's the nuns of the Dominican convent. This is the Daughters of Charity, and these two here. St. Joseph's, the Christian Brothers, are here. This is Neffin Road / Blind Lane. This owned by a man called Simon Mangan, as is this, a big cattle dealer. Because again, the cattle market is a huge influence on the area. So he had land for grazing and overnighting cattle before the market. The purple bits are the Begg family. Now, people know Beggsborough and Cabra, the Beggsborough house. This is the Begg family. So they date back to the 16th century in Cabra as big landowners. So they had land in the area, and they had a presence in Beggsborough House, the family had until the 80s. Then as we go up across, this is Neffin Road. This is the Reed family. People remember the garage, well, it's still there, the garage in the Neffin Road was owned by the Reed family. They had a lot of presence around the place. You see the land they have here in what's now Crowpatrick, Neffin Road, at the start of Villa Park there. Villa Park Road type of area, and here near the houses near the brook, or they would build houses near the brook. They had land, and right up again until the transfer of freeholds in the 1990s, they were the leaseholders on a lot of people's land in the area. The pink area here, or say the brown areas where I'm from, so I should mention two Wilkinson brothers owned cattlemen again. Owned that, but it was a market garden at the time. The pinkish land here near Bagot Road, that was the Bagot holding. So a man called Henry Bagot came here in 1880, built the Elm Grove House. He built the Elm Grove House and the land that around it was farmed. So what's now Belvedere, he took into his possession later, but what's now Connor Clune Road, Rattler Road, and those pinkish colours there. So he set up the pub there that was variously known as the Rose Tavern, I think over the years, and I'll come later to what he did with the Belvedere land. And then up the top you have a Mrs. McGrath owned stables in the silvery colour. Across the street was Peter Kelly, who was the governor of the halfway house. So he owned land behind it where developed some houses on that in later years. So this is what it looked like pre-development. So the blue now is institutional land, farmland. The green is non-institutional land, private land, but farm or grazed land. So it was essentially split into institutional farmland and private farmland. The purple bits are residential, and the brighter colours are private land. So there was a stables up in opposite the halfway house, and down at the very end where Springfield House was, was privately owned as well. So what happened in the 1930s? Yeah, so this is some of the dwellings along Blackhurst Avenue at the time. So this was Hampton Lodge. This was the corner of Neffin Road as it turned into Blackhurst Avenue. And this was here till the late 80s. And across the road from it was the Thatch Cottage, Primrose Cottage. Now, Hampton Lodge was another Reed premises, so they own that. And across the way was Primrose Cottage here, the Thatch Cottage. I only knew it until late. Now, this is a later picture, obviously, when the apartments were built. But this was dwelt in by a man called Sylvester Lawler, who also market gardened that crescent around it where those apartments were later be built. And Frank has told me this was a place, a Saturday night hoolies back in the day. You bring your own hooch, but you had to be out by midnight because you had to fast for Mass the next day. And fasting for Mass and going to Mass were no small thing, because the parish was part of the Chapel Lizard parish. So it was a long walk across the way to Mass. Further up Blackhurst Avenue was the alley. These dwellings people might remember from beside Comiskey's. So these were at the lowest end of the housing scale. These are privately owned. As an example, in the 1930s, where you get a lot of information, it's from rate books. So every house was rated depending on its value and its quality. So these were £2 a year rates on this. At the same time, a semi-detached house in Crowpatrick Road was £19 a year. So that it was well, and some of them, even you see in the books, it says dilapidated, and then it says, and so-and-so was living here, and the rate is £2. So they some of them did seem not to be unfit for human habitation, and apparently had healthy populations of rats in them. So the lower ones now, this is the better quality, further up, these are Elm Grove cottages, so these rural district council cottages I mentioned earlier, where they were built for agricultural labourers. These were built around 1900. All of those ones, the ones up on the Navan Road, the ones Roosevelt Colleges, Vincent's Colleges, Joseph's, and these were all from around that 1900 period. Across the road from that was the Blackhurst Tavern, which we know better, the Hole in the Wall. So this had a license going back to the 16th century, so it has a long and storied history. And at the point this picture is taken here, you can sort of, you might be able to make it out here, it says L. Doyle on it. So that's Lavinius Doyle. So he was the proprietor of it in from 1902 to 1913. When this picture was taken, his wife then took it over when he passed. She ran it in 1940, and a man called Clancy took it over at that point, who in turn sold it to T.J. McCaffrey. So that had that long presence. I think now it got a cachet as a bona fide house, but that was when the border of the city moved out. It was just beyond the border of the city, so if you're a bona fide traveller, you could get a drink here in Holy Hour. So what happened in 1930? That's the sort of baseline. Then 1930 to 1940, there was a bit of development down in Crowpatrick Road area, Villa Park. So we should go over here to point it out. This is Villa Park Avenue. This is sort of Crowpatrick Road, Screen Road area. The Reeds developed sort of between the brook and the petrol station, and a little bit of development on Baggett Land here on the Navan Road, beyond Baggett Road there. In terms of this district here that was converted, I'll come back to it. This became Crowpatrick Road, Slemish Road, Screen Road, Ardpatrick Road, all about St. Patrick. So that was the tradition at the time, to pick a theme. So people behind James's Gate Brewery direction, there's a place to the locals called Maryland, because all the roads are Loretto Street, Rosary Road, Ave Maria Avenue, these kind of things. So they had a theme, you know, in Crumlin there's Clon McNoy's, Clonard, Monaster Boyce Road, after monasteries. So here, St. Patrick was the theme for this one. It was also developed here in Villa Park, the first Villa Park. So this is from 1936. So when Christopher Keogh, the man I mentioned, lived in Cabra Villa and the cattle business, he owned the land, and he there was houses he developed on his land. So it was opened with some fanfare in 1936. The minister, Sean T. O'Kelly, later president, turned up to open them. He was the minister for local government at the time. So houses were £800 for a house. So 12 shillings a week for 20 years, and it was yours. And you know, there was flags flying and banners. So it was a big event, because the reason it was such a big event, they were built by the Tramway Workers Union through a vehicle called a Public Utility Society. So these are basically housing co-ops you could set up with your trade union. There's a group of people coming together. And you got special remission on rates. You got special help in getting the land ready with land acquisition from the government. So what it was people that didn't qualify for local authority housing but would struggle to fund their house themselves. This was the government's way of helping them. So in this way, the tramway workers were getting together to build houses for their members. Between 1940 and 1950, so the extra development, a slightly lighter colour, if you can see it here, sort of where Ard Patrick Road is, and over opposite Belvedere Sports Ground and along Backett Road. Now, there wasn't a whole lot of development in the 1940s. Here, there was big developments like Cabra and Crumlin, but even they struggled because of a lack of materials during the war, and bigger again, the lack of men. But there was a boom time in England for builders during the war and after the war, so it was hard to get builders here, and the costs were going through the roof, and there was various programs by the government to come back to Erin, to go to England to try and get builders to come back here. So that's why there wasn't as much, and you'll see when you come to 1950, how much more work was done, even though that's sort of seen as a lost economic decade. But there was some development here. An interesting development is 1943, the sale of the Bagot land to the Jesuits. So these were, this is what Belvedere is today. They sold that to the Jesuits. That initially been a polo ground for the British Army, and at independence it was offered to the Civil Service Athletic Club. They didn't want it because they said it was too waterlogged, but the Jesuits, being the smart men they are, they bought it. They put a lot of money into drainage, and it's still operating as a fine resource. But what's interesting, and you won't see from there, but you take a word for it here, is the lessor here. So the lessor is typically the owner of the land, or at least the freehold owner. So this is Bagot selling to the Jesuits. But the lesser is O'Neill Seagrave. So one of these Seagraves, I was saying, was here since the Battle of Clontarf, still had interest in the land here. And until the 1990s, when all those freeholds were bought out, the people had title to these lands going back hundreds of years. So this is an aerial photo from the park. I call it Windy Harbour because Windy Harbour was what the Navan, if you look at the maps from this area, from Bagot Road there down to Cabra Cross, was called Windy Harbour. And so what we're looking down on here, so this is a development in screen. Half of the shoe horse of Ard Patrick has been developed. This is Neffin Road here. So Neffin Road used to be blind lane and used to cross the Navan Road here, and we take a mad dash like this along a ditch. And when Cabra was developed, they rerouted Neffin Road to align with Fossa Avenue. And then Belvedere, the houses opposite Belvedere there, and then past Bagot Road, you can see these the houses built by, again, another public utilities are the Economic Public Utility Society. These are very popular in the 1930s and 40s. Looking across now, this is from a different angle, the same era, 1947, This is the Sean T. O'Kelly opening here. This is the Patrick team estate. And why I like this picture is because I spoke to a man who was born in a house here, a man called Aidan Mulligan. People remember the TD Dermot Fitzpatrick. Yeah. It's his cousin who grew up next door to him. And he's still hale and hearty. And he talks to me, he was born in 1941, and talks to me about playing in the street here. And he resented when they finished the shoehorn. This is their playground, essentially. But also, he talks about, and it comes out in the picture, the Navan Road was very quiet in those days. and they'd be out playing, and you could just hear the racket coming over from Cabra of the thousands of children over there. Like, if you look at the proportionate size of Cabra to Navan Road here, because this is where most of the building was at this stage, the Navan Road, but Cabra had been built again to ease out the crowding in the city, and then had been hastily occupied when the Germans bombed the North Strand. They started putting people in there. So between 1950 and 1960, as I said earlier, it accelerated. So the bright yellow, you can see, sorry, I'm going to move again. So the Kinvara district here, the Bagot lands were developed there. Villa Park was all developed. Martin's Grove, and up here, Darling Estate. So there's a lot, I'm saying, for all the talk of a lost era, if you were here and had the money for a house, there was a lot going on in the 1950s. The church opened in 1952. So I was saying, we were part of the Chapel Lizard Parish, and then in they call it Chapel Lizard in their yearbooks. I can find Chapel, Cabra end of the Chapel Lizard Parish. But a new church, the church obviously knew what was planned for the development here. So a 1,700 seat church was built in 1952. So they bought the land off the nuns in the late 1940s. One field for the church, and then a couple of years later, they bought another field for the schools. So they would build both in turn. So 1952, the church was completed, and it was opened by the man himself, John Charles McQuaid. Here came out to open it, and I love just the rural scene of it here with the bushes when the church was built. The school was the Bosco's Junior School was built in 1955. And then, so the boys were there in the junior school. The girls went to the Phoenix Park School still. And then 1969, the big schools were opened that we know. Are two stories, two or three stories that the schools opened? Three story schools were opened. So the initial development of Canberra. So this is a picture from 1954 from the race course looking down. So here's that's Cabra West Church over there. And this is Navan Road Church here. So this road here, this is the initial development of Canberra Park. So Canberra Park was the first area developed off the road. So you can see the houses starting to go up there. And again, I know it's difficult to see from down there, but what's very, very clear from it is how it was determined by fields, that the development stops at the end of a field, then they go and buy another field from the nuns, they build some more. So it was very much how fields determined where the building went. Lynham's built Canberra. The Lynhams are one of the Lynhams, those two Lynham brothers, Edward and James, I want to say, one of whom lived on the Navan Road. They developed Canberra, and when I do the searches back, they were the most active people of all the developers in the area, in the newspapers. They were good at getting their names in the paper and putting their ads in the paper. So this is the first thing about Canberra. In 1954, Canberra Park is on the main road to Navan, close to wide open space at the Phoenix Park. A new school for boys and girls is planned. At present, children go to the Phoenix Park School. Castleknock College is close by. A race course nearby. Many beautiful walks around Ashdown are within easy reach. So that was their pitch, to get sort of a colour piece in the newspaper. And then in 1955, this is them advertising in the Evening Herald for the house. So the house is now 1,680 euros in Canberra Avenue. And you'll see here it says supplementary grant in certain cases. So what this was about is, this is line and building targeting a certain market. So I spoke about the public utility societies were to help people who weren't on the local authority list, but would struggle to fund a house. So the public utility societies helped them. This supplementary grant were people who were on the local authority list, but would volunteer themselves out of it with a grant to buy a private house, so they could get a grant from the government. So Lynham is saying, because this, but you'll qualify for a grant, and it makes the house cheaper. And then the lower one here is a bit later. In 1960, Canberra Road has now been developed. So that was another field. So Canberra Road is being developed. Now, both of these mention, building contractors' office on site. So that's one of these things here. You see this fella crouching down beside the hook. Now, this isn't the Navan Road. This is Collins Avenue. So you turned up to view the house, And if you liked it, you went into the hut there and you signed up and you gave your deposit and you were on. You were on the housing ladder. Rattra Park, again, this might be difficult to see from the distance. This is from, so Rattra in 1954, Rattra Park is now starting to develop here, and Conor Clune would come up here. I found some interesting stuff about the naming of this whole area. It was a minefield. Initially, it was to be called after Dick McKee, Patter Clancy and Conor Clune, who were all murdered on the night of Bloody Sunday. They were murdered in, tortured and murdered in Dublin Castle. And it was to be named after the roads, and also Martin Savage. So what became Rattra Park was Martin Savage Road at one point. And the locals complained, and there's a whole series of letters into the corporation where they're saying, they're trying to say, no disrespect to the Patriot dead, but there's houses up, there's streets over in Finglas with the same name, and people might get confused. And could you call them all Bagot Road, Bagot Crescent? And then a man called Pierce Beasley, who was an accomplice of Michael Collins, he was the head of the old IRA society, and he was right in outrage that they should try and wipe these names off the map. But ultimately, a compromise was hit. So they were called Rattra. So Rattra houses in the park. That's where Douglas Hyde lived after he was president for a few years. And it's called Rattra because his home place in Roscommon is Rattra House. So that's where that was the compromise. And I don't know if there's anything to this, but Conor Clune, Dick McKee, and Patter Clancy were IRA members. Conor Clune was a friend of theirs, happened to be in the house with them and was picked up. He wasn't a member. So I don't know if that had anything to do with him, his name surviving for the area, but that's how the naming went there. So just to wrap it all together, so this is how it was pre-development. That blue land is the institutional farmland, Greenland, institutional farmland. By the end of the 60s, this dark brownish colour has come in. This is the suburbs. The pink is the public park. And then by year 2000, it spread right across, and the religious institutions have reduced area in their land still associated with them, and the rest is a suburb. So I mentioned in passing the Civic Survey, one of these reports in 1925 about the state of Dublin and what should be done. It ended with the exhortation, "Let our citizens resolve that Dublin will have a great future." And I leave to your judgment if Navin Road has fulfilled on that. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Dublin Festival of History. The festival is brought to you by Dublin City Council and organised by Dublin City Libraries, in partnership with Dublin City Council Culture Company. For further podcast episodes and for all the latest festival news, be sure to visit dublinfestivalofhistory.ie or follow us on Instagram.